Welcome to Blondie and the Brit, Writing, Publishing, and Beyond. You can find our show notes and more information about our podcast at blondieandbrit.com. That's BLONDIEANDBRIT.com. Welcome to Blondie and the Brit podcast. I am Blondie, KJ Waters.
And I'm Suzanne Cowman, I'm the Brit.
And together we're Blondie and the Brit.
Yay!
Woohoo! I am the author of Stealing Time.
And I'm the author of The Rejected Writer's Book Club.
Please pop over to my blog, kjwatersauthor.blogspot.com, to vote on all our Audience Choice Awards. Voting ends Friday, October 7th, so hurry, don't delay. Welcome to Blondie and the Brit. This week we have the second part of our awards show. We have done our Listener's Choice Awards and voting is going on right now. We have our last couple categories up. Voting ends this Friday, October 7th. So I hope you get a chance to go to my blog and vote for all your favorites of each of these nine categories. And then on October 14th, at 5 p.m. Central, we are going to have an amazing Facebook party. Right, Suzanne?
Yeah, we can't wait. We're excited. We've got our balloons. We've got our cake. We're ready to go.
Yep, we are so good to go. And that's where we're going to announce all the winners of each of these categories. So it should be fun. Hopefully the authors will come and mingle and we'll have a nice fun time. So with that said, let's get started. The second half of our voting starts with our most helpful writing process. And this one, we talk about different techniques that authors use to help themselves write. And I'm using all of these now. Well, maybe not all of them, but I want to use all of these. So in this category, we have Melody Robinette with the Pomodoro Method, Graham Ng, Deb Lund, Terry Persson, and Ellie Alexander. And we'll talk about those in a second. But let's first start with Melody Robinette.
Yeah, let's talk. She uses a great method called the Pomodoro Method. And if you don't know about it, why don't you listen to her clip so you can see what that's all about?
We need to know about the Pomodoro Method.
I'm obsessed with that now.
Awesome.
Seriously, anyone who's a writer, I'm like, oh my gosh, have you tried the Pomodoro Method? And it's called the Pomodoro Method because, you know those old kitchen timers in the shape of a tomato?
Yeah.
That's why it's called that.
Oh, that's hilarious.
The Pomodoro. So basically, it's not just for writing, but you set your timer, and there's even an app on your iPhone that you can download that has this specific timer and break and everything built into it. But you set your timer for 25 minutes and you are literally not allowed to do anything but write. You can't check your phone. You can't get up. You can't go warm up your coffee. Like, you can't do anything for 25 minutes other than write. And you do that straight through. So you get a 5-minute break and you have to force yourself to take that break. Like, look away from the screen, get up, heat up your coffee, whatever. And when that 5 minutes is over, you sit back down and you do that as many times as it takes until you get the word count you want. I'm a teacher, so I have to get up early to write. I wake up at 5 o'clock to write for about an hour and a half. And before, I was maybe hitting 1,000 words if I was lucky, because I would get stuck on Facebook or on Pinterest, anything but writing. I would write 2 sentences and then, well, I don't know what I'm going to write next, so I'm going to go check Facebook. And then I'd be on there for 30 minutes. And it was just a mess. And then when I started the Pomodoro Method, I have been getting up to over 2,000 words in an hour and a half. And that's with 15-minute breaks.
So you doubled your productivity. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's incredible. But I mean, I think it's that you're forcing yourself.
I used the Pomodoro Method yesterday and trying to write, and it was very helpful. I got a lot more done than I expected to, and it just kind of kept me focused, knowing that I had a reward coming up, to a 5-minute break. So I'm enjoying it. I think it was great advice.
Yeah, it really, I've done it in the past, and exactly the same thing. When I've had struggled to get, focused, it's worked really well for me too.
Perfect. Okay, so the next person in this category is Graham Ng, and what a great interview. If y'all haven't listened to his, he's so inspiring. He's got so many good tips. And he gave us a really great tip on Scrivener, which is a software program that you use to help organize your manuscript. It also helps you when you go to format it and upload it into different formats. So here's Graham.
So Scrivener, it's kind of an awkward thing to describe. Authors seem to love or hate it. you'll find probably as many people don't like Scrivener as like it. But it's a piece of software put out by an English company, actually, Literature and Latte. And it's intended to be a soup-to-nut solution. So basically, it'll provide a very flexible sandbox for you to go all the way from building your outline, through writing the book, through editing the book. And in fact, it will also format. So it will help you format for paperback, Mobi, EPUB, wow, the whole thing.
Just that alone makes me want to use it. But I think there's a pretty big learning curve, isn't there, to figure out how.
I was going
to
say, that was my point. I actually don't like Scrivener for that reason, the learning curve. I mean, I know that if I could just get through that learning curve, I'd probably love it.
You can get by with, you know, 10% of what there is in there. But the more you start learning about it, the more it helps you out. There's actually quite a few video courses online to teach you Scrivener. It is complicated, that's true.
Yeah.
And that's why some authors don't like it, right?
Yeah.
One of the things I love most about Scrivener is everything you do is in one file. So your book is in that file. All your research notes are in that same file. I like to put a lot of pictures in my research folder so that it can inspire me. For example, every one of my character sheets that I make has a picture that I've kind of pulled that I think looks like that character. Mm. So it inspires me when I'm writing them. Pull in web links. You can just pull in whole articles and you store it all in the research folder. And then there's also your manuscript in there. Another really cool thing about Scrivener is, if imagine you're using Microsoft Word and you decide you want to move a scene around. Let's say you've got a conversation and you decide, hey, I want that in an earlier scene. You have to cut it and you have to scroll up to the other scene and you have to paste it in.
Right.
In Scrivener, if you've divided it up into scenes, well, you literally drag and drop one little thing in the list of scenes and it's literally half a second that you're done.
So, yeah, that's great. Once again, just to listen to that another time, KJ. And for all of you that out there are struggling with Scrivener, that was a really good little introduction into that. So thank you for that, Graham.
Yes, good job, Graham. Now, the next one we have is Deb Lund, and she was a lot of fun to have the program. She talks about fiction magic.
I would love to tell you about Fiction Magic. It's Fiction Magic Card Tricks and Tips for Writers, and it's a 54-card deck. And the whole purpose is to get more conflict and suspense in novels or any type of fiction writing. But it's also amazed me how much response I've gotten from people where they've used it in all kinds of different ways, not even just for writing. But the whole concept is that you draw a card, and these have evolved over my 25 years of teaching writing and since my master's project on teaching writing. And so you can have a card that says something like, lose the prized possession. Well, for me, you know, my mind would just start spinning then on what that could mean. And often people might not have a prized possession in their writing or not think they do, but if they look at the manuscript, they can, oh yeah, that's right. He loved that, you know, that book. And so it's like, then what can happen to that book? You know, what can you do? But I also have a guidebook. Give your characters objects that become symbolic. A key, a book, a family heirloom, a map. Make the objects crucial to your stories, and along with their intended physical uses, make them metaphors. What do the objects represent, or what powers do they have? What will be lost when the objects are lost? Once their importance is established, take the objects away and bring on the consequences. So that's the first part. And then in each one, I always have something for the writer too. There's a second paragraph that, you know, where I get a chance to do my creativity coaching. And that one for this one says, writers may have their own talismans, special writing tools, candles, or other objects. Collect and display quotes, pictures, and positive comments to inspire your writing. Let your prized possessions surround and ground you.
So you twist it. Yeah, at first the character gets theirs taken away, but you get to keep all yours so that you can write them.
So, yeah, what a great idea. And I know Deb, and I've actually worked with her cards, and I just think, what a smart, wonderful idea. I hope people take her up on buying a pack of those, because they are definitely worth it when you're in a hole.
Yeah, well, even I was just thinking how fun it would be just to kind of thumb through those, you know, just to spice up, okay, this chapter's a little bit boring, let me add a few things to it. I don't know, I just think it'd be a lot of fun. Plus, I think if I gave them to my kids, seriously, I'd go crazy on that. Yep. And next, one of our favorite podcasts was with Terry Persson. We actually had a giant snafu in the middle of that and had to record him again. And that second recording, we turned into two different podcasts. So if not had a chance to listen to his, he has some really good creative writing advice. And here's what we give to you from his wealth of knowledge.
Learning how to separate my controlled life, if you will, the things I have to do and all that kind of stuff, from your creative life, which is totally free, is a skill that everyone should be trying to create. So that when I walk out of my office and I'm not thinking, oh, I've got to do this, this, and this, I'm looking around and I'm experiencing the moment and smelling the air and listening to outside conversations and kind of letting everything in. Because I've read probably 50 or 60 books on how the brain works and why it works that way and how to free it up, kind of like getting in the zone or whatever you want to call it. But being able to turn things off, those critics and that planning and all those things, they don't help you with your creativity. I think that, and my daughter and I talk about this once in a while, Nicole, and we're both very prolific. And I think that it allows that because your creativity doesn't stop you. You know, you don't get into a spot and say, well, I can't write that now because I'm working on this, or you don't have any of those blocks.
Yeah, and this for me was a huge one. You know, I've talked about this before, KJ, but this is my number one goal, is to still implement what Terry says about just being engaged in the community around you, you know, all the time to get inspiration. So I love this clip.
Yeah, I did too. Very inspiring. And thank you, Terry, for all your kindness to us. Next is Ellie Alexander, and she talks about how she writes books that have to do with baking and stuff. And so we found it really entertaining when she describes how she drafts her stories in layers. Here it is.
So I spend a lot of time before I actually even start writing, figuring out each potential suspect and what they are lying about or what they're hiding, because that is then constantly shifting suspicion somewhere and hopefully leading you down a wrong trail. So that's the first piece that I do of plotting. And then I write a complete first draft, start to finish. She might reference something that she's cooking in the moment in my first drafts. And then once I let the draft sit for a little while, I go back in and I layer in the food as an entirely second draft. So while it's resting, once I've finished a first draft, I will actually cook recipes and bake and, you know, get that sensory experience of what does it feel like when I'm working with the dough and what does it smell like when something's rising in the oven. And I'll just take notes through that whole process. And then I'll go in and I'll do a second draft of just food.
That is cool.
Wow, I love that. So you would say to your husband, I'm in draft two, and he goes, okay, I better get new pants because you know.
New pants.
No,
it takes a while. I would say at least a few months I spend just working on baking. I watch a lot of Food Network baking shows. I go to bakeries and coffee shops. Like, I just really try to immerse myself in that. And it is no joke. My husband and my 12-year-old are my official taste testers. Ooh. So, you know, when I first started writing the series, they would get really excited. But now, you know, I'm working on book 6 or something. I'm farther out than what's coming out. And they'll see me coming with a plate of something and be like, oh, no.
Not again.
No, I think it's just, it is sort of organic because I'm taking multiple passes. I really want the food to feel like a character in the book.
Okay, yeah, I loved what Ellie had to say there. I loved the way she attacked her writing process. She just loved it and respected it and did it in those layers. I think that was such a great piece of advice for us.
Yeah, I do too. And that ends the category. That's the most helpful writing process. Please go over to my blog and vote for which one you thought was the best. It's KJ Waters Author. blogspot.com, and I have the voting for this week up right now, and we have, you know, a couple of all kinds of other things to vote on. So go to the bottom of that blog post and you'll see the other categories to vote on. Next category, most inspired storytelling, and these were some really cool ways that our authors were inspired to write their particular books. And first we start off with Kara O'Brien, and she talks about how the drought in California inspired her YA novel.
And what happened is that my husband was on a sabbatical from his university position, so I took a leave of absence from my high school English teaching position for a semester, and we drove out to California, and along the way, we were driving through the southern states, and we ran into the drought that was happening back in, I guess this was 2008 at the time.
Yeah.
This comes out of my drive across the country when the lakes had no water in them. It was very disturbing to me. I really started thinking then about what would happen when climate change happened. And it sort of hit me in the face, well, that's not the future anymore. That's really happening right now. And I just thought, well, what's going to happen if it gets worse? And would people from America move to Canada to avoid the heat? And I don't know, all these ideas just started churning. So when I got to California with my family, my husband, and at that time, two of our kids were with us, I started writing this young adult novel, which turned out to be Birthmarked. And I just was fascinated by it and having a lot of fun with it and sort of pushing myself every day to keep working on it and not give up.
You know what I loved about this clip, KJ? It was like I could actually feel her journey that she was on as she was telling us about how she was inspired. Like I could see it. Even though I haven't read her book, I could see everything she was talking about. And so I could see why that would inspire her.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because I made that same trip across the country to California, and I did see it. It's still a drought now, even though that was, for her, it was years ago, 2008. So yeah, I can definitely see how that would inspire her. For sure. Now, next in this category of most inspired storytelling, we have Ian McKenzie, and he's from South Africa. And he tells us how his book was inspired by some political scenes in his country.
In the early 1980s, South Africa was facing a very similar problem to what Rhodesia had been facing the previous 15 years. They were faced with economic problems that were being created as a result of their failure to acknowledge that equal rights and democracy should come to South Africa. You've obviously heard the term apartheid, which needs a lot of explanation for people who've only heard the word and given a connotation. But effectively what it is total segregation of the races. And that was frowned upon by the international community. And so Andrew Mason comes back into South Africa and he's confronted with this stuff, but now he's confronted with these bankers who have got a lot of money, a lot of power, but they've also got a lot of thugs working for them. And they try and take Andrew out. And he decides he needs to find out what is so important about all this. And he then starts to investigate or getting behind the scenes and find, and he discovers the cell of terrorism which is being created by what, you know, the African National Congress, who today are our government, but in those days were considered a terrorist organization and the enemy. So he is at the same time starting to see that this whole race thing was wrong. And everything he fought for was wrong. Because essentially it is. So he's starting to see this. So he, once again, he gets himself into a huge psychological mixed up, and he is now going to try and unravel all this. And so one never knows who the good guys or who the bad guys are in this whole thing. And that will obviously pan itself out as time goes by.
Yeah, I loved listening to that clip. You know what I loved about Ian was I felt like he took us on a journey of the history of his country while we were listening to it. And that was a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, it was really interesting too, because like you said, we usually don't hear too much about South Africa here. So it was really neat. And then, you know, maybe it pulled me into the story a lot, just learning about, you know, some of the turmoil that we've not had to deal with. So very nice clip there. Now, our next one in this category is Vaughn Murphy. Okay, so this is near and dear to my heart because Vaughn is a science fiction author. She tells us a couple of the things that she has read that inspired parts of her book. She's got two different books that kind of brought into play with this clip right here.
So I can't stress enough. Read. Read everything. Read articles. You never know where your inspiration is going to come from. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that the things that you're reading are correct or the absolute law on whatever subject they're discussing, but you have absolutely no idea how what you read day to day is going to inspire you.
Chimera thing, is that something that you found like in the news or something that spawned the very first book?
It was an article about a medical condition called chimerism, where you can share DNA in the womb with your mother. They're actually doing research on how much DNA we have of other people, possibly our ancestors even. We're not really sure. You know, we tend to think of a person is born and they have this DNA and that's it. But there could be some mixture, you know, from being in the womb, whenever your mother's carrying you. Mm-hmm. And then there's also different aspects of chimerism where, like twins, where one twin absorbs another twin, and then you have one baby with two different sets of DNA.
Right.
So
interesting stuff. Wow.
I read another article and came up with a fantasy story. It was an article from the Dominican Republic where there are children born that are born for all intents and purposes looking like girls. And then at the age of 12, they change to boys. And it's a phenomenon particular to that area. It's not common. And it made me think of, okay, well, what if there were people that did that, but there was a magical reason for it? Mm-hmm. And then that sort of spawned a whole other book that I've already bought it.
Yeah, well, do you know what was great about this? And it was, that's why I think we chose this clip, was just her research, you know? And sometimes we forget that, you know, that kind of research can totally take you on a story that you didn't even think about.
Exactly.
And I thought that was so interesting, what she came up with and the research that she found.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was really neat how she said, you know, read everything, because you just don't know where your next story idea is going to come from. So
if you get
a chance, listen to her whole interview. She's got a lot of really good, inspiring tips and very focused writer she is, so. Next in our most inspired writing category, we have Amy Quick Parrish. This is such an interesting story. Amy talks about how she started with a web series and then it went into a TV pilot and then turned into novel. And it's quite an interesting journey. Listen.
I had time to think about it. And, you know, I thought through her outfit and I went up shopping up and down Austin, South Congress, has these really cool stores, and found this really neat necklace, which kind of changed the script. It was a turquoise and silver Thunderbird necklace.
Ooh.
And so I got Jamie that necklace. And then we had some kind of technical difficulties getting her to look like she was going to fly. And between this and that,
you do, you know, how many times?
Yeah, she became somebody who could turn into a Thunderbird. And that was kind of her thing. Kind of, you know, like Batman has the bat and Zorro, you know, the cape. And so it's kind of a combination of all those things. And so really the story evolved by doing more with it. So we made the web series. And it was really great to see these characters and hear the dialogue and have things kind of come to life and see the scenery. And it was, you know, it still wasn't quite what I wanted to tell. So I wrote a pilot, still didn't nail down the story. And so I finally kind of came to the idea that I had a lot of things that were working and I had some things that weren't working. And a lot of it had to do with how much I was able to make happen in film. So I just took the scenes I liked and that were really working, and I literally copied them and pasted them in the Word file. Yeah, so it was kind of cool that I could just unlearn everything I learned about screenwriting and fill in details and describe everything and go on about her emotions and what she's thinking. And yeah, so the novel started to kind of come through, and that's where I could really make the story happen.
Yeah, that was such a great clip because I loved the process that, she kind of followed the crumbles of, you know, breadcrumbs, you know. She knew that one thing led to another that led to another that led to another. And I thought that was really interesting that she just went with that. And I loved that.
Yeah. Good, interesting a job that she has with all those varying layers. I loved it. All right, next in this category, we have Barbara Cecil Taylor. And I found this really fascinating. She tells how she lived in the grounds of a correctional facility. And it seems that that experience has woven into all of her books. So I found that really fascinating. Here's her clip.
What direction I would go in, I actually thought I would write historical fiction until the day I sat down and wrote the first page of the first novel I ever wrote, when I drew on my experience living on the grounds of that first offender prison in Kentucky. And I didn't realize what an impression it had made on me until a few years later when I did sit down to write. And what came out was a crime that was committed and the effect it had on this family. And I think it was because living there, we interacted with the inmates. They took care of everything. They did all of the yard work around our homes. They did all of the maintenance on our cars. And in the course of that, you found that you were talking to these inmates. And so you understood why the crime they committed, their story about why it happened, what they hoped to do about it and about themselves. And then there were days when their families would come, their parents, their siblings. We interacted with those people too. And some of the stories that I heard were just heartbreaking. And some were hopeful. Some were very hopeful. And there were miracles that happened. It was really an incredible experience.
Yeah, who would have thought that living in a jail, you know, the specificity, would inspire you to be a storyteller. And I just thought it was fascinating how she'd really connected with the lives of the people that lived there. And you always tend to think of them being sort of these bad people, but it sounded like, you know, there was people that just got into bad situations, and she wanted to take from that. And I loved that she used that to inspire her for her work.
Yeah, absolutely. And her tension she creates are around like criminal type situations, and it's all like how the families are affected. So, you know, if you're into that kind of thing, I think her books would be really meaningful to you. So check them out. All right, next in our little category here, and our last one in this category, is Emily Drake Carpenter. I really enjoyed this interview. She got the very first idea for her story while she was in the bathtub. And I thought this was hilarious because this is what all of us writers do, you know, in the weirdest times we come up with these amazing ideas. And this is her little clip.
One night I was taking a bath. And, you know how people talk about how they have some of their great ideas in the bath.
Yeah,
and the shower. I don't know what it is. So I'm in the bathtub and I start sort of mulling through different ideas that I think are intriguing. Suddenly I get the idea of a woman who is on the eve of her 30th birthday, which is, you know, obviously kind of a momentous birthday for people, maybe women especially. As she's about to turn 30, she realizes or learns that the women in her family, her mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, all mysteriously disappeared and or died on their 30th birthdays.
Ooh.
And wow. The secret's been kept from her for various reasons, which I won't go into. But she's got to figure out what happened to the women and how to prevent it from happening to her.
Ooh, that sounds so good. It does. It's such a great idea.
Oh, thank you. So, okay, so I come up with this idea in the bathtub, and I get really excited and jump out of the bathtub and towel off and put on my pajamas, I think, and I'm running to the bedroom where my husband's in bed, and I basically just pitch him the idea, and he sits up and he's like, oh, that's it. That is a great idea.
Oh, you have a good husband. Like, yeah. That's awesome.
And his next question is, well, so what is it? What happened to them on their 30th birthday? And I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, you know what? What a delight Emily was to interview. She was such a fun interview, and I loved how honest she was about that, because you're absolutely right. You know, you never know when you're going to be inspired, and all of a sudden it can be any time. I love the way her husband responded, and it was a really fun story.
Yeah, it was good stuff. Okay, so now our next category. This is a really good one, too. The best professional publishing tips. So these are people who are professionals in the field, and they're providing us with their little kernels of advice. So our very first one is Suzanne's agent, Andrea Hurst, and she gives us some really valuable advice on how to approach an agent.
So an agent in general, I'll talk to agents as a whole rather than just for me, because my standards are a little different now. But an agent as a whole, the best way is if you can get them in person. Many agents travel to conferences, they go to pitch fests, they give classes. If you can get them FaceTime, if you can get them listening and actually requesting your project and something they might remember, that's the best way. The second best is to send a query letter following the exact instructions on their website. It's a little harder because we get so many. But that would be the second best way. Right. And make sure you research which ones you pitch. Yeah, I'm always really surprised that someone will take the time to do an email pitch and not have gone to my website. Because on my website, there's not only clear instructions, but it'll say, we represent this type of nonfiction, we represent this kind of fiction. And it clearly says what we don't represent. And yet we still get queries for that, which go right into the trash.
Her interview was so great. There was so much advice that it was hard. And she was another one that was hard to pick a clip from because everything was so good. So, yeah, you do need to listen to this one too if you're interested in seeing the publishing world from an agent's point of view, because she gave us a really good insight into that. And I love this clip. I thought this was great advice.
Yeah, it was. And she's also a writer, so she's got a different take than just someone who is strictly an agent. So she's actively publishing books. So next in this category of our published professional publishing tips is Gisela Hausman. She had so many different things that she's an expert in. It was also hard to figure out which one we want to pick from her. But what I chose was the email evangelist. This is something that she claims saved her life.
The truth about emails is the following. Every one of us has 200 emails. And if we're really, really truthful, if we really go deep down, we hate 170 of these 200 emails. We hate them. We hate the people. We hate the way how they're written. We hate what they want. We just hate them. So what happens? As soon as we have defined which ones we hate, we look at the ones that we like and we say, Jesus, before I deal with these people that I hate, I deal with the ones that I like. So the most important point for any author is the more effort you put into this one email, the better your chance that the person says, oh my God, look at this 170 I hate. I'm not going to look at 171 or 183 which I like. And that means they're going to give you what you want because they want to like somebody. And never tailor a template, never be run off a wheel. Make your case in a personal way. When you write a reviewer, this is how you should write your email. You should make it like the dating email. Hey, reviewer, meet my book. She wants to go on a ride with you. That's the way it is. And your chances to succeed will be tremendously higher because though not every reviewer will want to read the book, maybe it's not their topic.
Right.
But the ones who like it will like it even more because it sounds juicy, interesting, tasty, fabulous. Avoid the standard run-of-the-mill sentences. Like, keep your email concise. Shoot for about 150 words. I keep saying a screenful. Don't make that reviewer scroll along. Just present your case concise in a screenful, 550 words.
Yeah, good old, I love that clip. And you know, you wouldn't even, I didn't even think about email when I send them out. So listening to that clip really changed it for me on to really be focused when you send out emails to get your message across in the way that she talks about was great advice.
Yeah, very good advice. And it goes across everything you do, whether you're an author or just, you know, a regular person trying to connect with people. Email really is important. And I kind of, like you, I just kind of don't pay that much attention to it. But since I listened to her podcast, I am definitely way more focused when I send emails out. Okay, now our next person in this category was Evan Marshall, and he's also an agent. And one of the things that I found very valuable from him is he explains why people need an agent. And so from his perspective, this is what they can do for you.
The main thing I think an agent does is help you set your goals in your career. If you don't have anyone guiding you, you can just drift from one contract to another, one novel to another, without really having any goal in mind. And before you know it, 30 years have passed, and you've been doing the exact same thing and didn't ever really have a plan. So one thing I enjoy doing with my own authors is helping them create a plan, set goals, and then we work together to reach those goals. Another thing that a good agent can do is give you some editorial feedback, give you some ideas on your proposals, on your manuscripts. We also work with editors a lot, and editors ask us, do you have an author who could write a blank? Or, I have an idea for a novel, and I think people on your list might be right to do this. Can you find me someone? Mm-hmm. I don't think the public is quite aware of how often that happens, where editors go looking for someone to write a book, and a good agent can be a doorway into those kinds of projects. And the other thing, of course, is financially speaking, we will find markets for your work that you can't reach without an agent. For example, we can help place your translation rights. We can help place your British rights. We can help place your audio rights, your large print, and God willing, we can help you get an option in Hollywood for film or TV. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things an agent brings to the equation.
Yeah, Evan, he was another joy to interview, wasn't he? We had a fun lightning round with him as well. You should go listen to his lightning round, you guys, because it is very fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, just another great advice. You know, loved it. Loved what he had to say. And I love that we learn something every week, KJ.
Yeah, me too. That's one of the things I love about this podcast. Every single week, there's something brand new that I thought I knew and I didn't, or I didn't even know existed. So it's been...
Right.
It's been such a fun year. I mean, to think about how many podcasts we've done and how many really amazing authors that we've met, it's yeah, kind of like a huge honor to know these people now on a different level and have those connections going forward. Okay, so now we have Jerry Walker, who happens to be my editor.
Does the editor do a free sample? So when I ask for 10 pages, it's so I can get a sense of, you know, where the story is going, the author's style, issues that might crop up. But then I will, if it's a critique, I give feedback on the first 5 pages for free. And if it's a proofreader or a copy edit, I just do like the first 2 pages, which is about 500 words, give or take. And I mean, it's enough for that person to get a sense of your approach. So, you know, with critiquing, the art is to be critical, but yet in a positive way. You know, it's like, because everyone has strengths and weaknesses. So, you know, does the editor treat you, you know, I think it is a living, breathing human being who has feelings, because as a former teacher, that's, you know, something that in feedback, there really is an art form. So, you know, a lot of people hire an editor without that understanding of what level of editing do I need. And also too, you know, I would think copy editing, you know, does the editor do a style sheet?
What exactly is a style sheet?
Well, a style sheet is, it's just kind of like a guide for the book. And style sheets, you know, track anything from giving you a short chapter summary, you know, the editor will list all the names of the characters. When I did Stealing Time for KJ, it was, you know, I know a lot about the German language and linguistics. If there's a foreign accent, like to have a part on the style sheet that keeps track of all of that. If a word needs hyphenated or if Xbox gets a capital, you know, X on it, there's a place on the style sheet to put that. So if it was passed on to someone else.
Yeah, you know, she opened a whole world up to me about the style sheet. I didn't know any of that until I heard her interview, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and it's been hugely helpful. As I'm writing my second book, that's what I'm using, is going back and making sure I don't make those same mistakes, using the terminology I used in the first book. So it was really great organizing technique that I'd never heard of, and it's been very helpful for me. Okay, so in this category, we're still talking about our best professional publishing tips, and our last one here is Carly Cullen, and she does a lot of different things, but she's also an editor, and these are some of the things that she sees as an editor we thought was kind of an entertaining moment.
Do you ever see common mistakes that you wish you could tell people, please, this is the one thing that everybody does, don't do it? Do you have anything that's always common, or is everybody different?
There's a lot of things that are different, but my one bugbear is the word that. It is overused so much you wouldn't believe it.
Wow.
There was one manuscript I did, and I'll never forget it. There were over 3,000 that's that had to be removed.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of like something you use when you speak, but it isn't useful in your written word because it just clogs it up. It's a clutter word.
Yeah, it slows things down.
Carly had a wealth of information. She was just one of those people who just had a lot to say and a lot of interesting things about editing, which I think if you're interested in editing and, you know, the process of that, I think it's definitely worth listening to her interview because she had a lot to say that I thought was very valuable.
Yep, she sure did. And that concludes all the different categories we have. Now, what we want you to do is to go to my blog and vote on these. Each category, you can vote on one of the people we mentioned. So go to www.kjwaters.blogspot.com. And it's also in the very front and in the little blurb of this podcast. So you can just click on the link there and it'll take you there. We have all the different categories up there for voting. So please take a few minutes to vote on the two that are up. And then if you go through the past couple blogs, they're all there. And so vote. And then we want you to come to our Facebook party on October 14th. Please come in and join us. It's going to be super fun. We're going to announce the winners, and we're very excited to see who wins. I think I know a couple people who are going to win, but the rest of them, it's just who knows? Who knows what people are going
to
vote?
Just remind them of how do they get to the Facebook party, KJ? How do they link to that?
So if you go to the blog where you're going to vote, there is a little link on there, or you can go to our Facebook page, Blondie and the Brit, Writing, Publishing, and Beyond. And there we have a link right there that you can go and join the Facebook party. If you don't join the Facebook party, you won't see all the notifications and you won't be part of it because we don't want to bother the whole rest of Facebook with it. So to get in it, you have to join the Facebook party, or you can talk to Suzanne or I if you know us, and we can send you a link if that's easier as well. So thank you so much for making this an amazing year. And Suzanne, I have to say, this has been probably one of the most fun years ever because of you and all the fun energy that you bring. So thank you for being
a... Hey, right back at ya. We have a lot of fun. You can tell with the podcast that we really do have a lot of fun together.
Yes, we do. We love it. And I do want to tell you that later on, around Christmas time, we're going to do a blooper reel again, and you can see some of the ways that we totally screw up and just laugh at ourselves and each other. I mean, it's a lot of fun, and I'm hoping that you all get that vibe when we have the podcast. We just try to make it fun for the authors. It's not just boring, dry, let's talk about stuff. It's how to engage and get them playful and having a good time as well. So that's part of our deal, and we hope you join us for our Facebook party and just join us in celebrating. We're happy to have made it through a whole year, aren't we?
A lot of things make it through. We want to thank you, our audience, for listening, because without you guys, then there would be no need to do this. So that's we hope you continue to listen. We're always open to new ideas. Let us know. You can email us at our website, which is blondieandthebrit.com, I believe. Yep. Is it blondieandbrit.com?
Yep.
And we'd love to hear anything you've got to say. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to another year.
You can find our show notes and more information about our podcast at blondieandbrit.com. That's BLONDIEANDBRIT.com.